So I'm just going to jump right into our first question here. So can you please introduce yourself for the listeners and identify, and who or what you identify as?
I am from the Tsimshian Nation on the west coast of Turtle Island. I'm a mother of two adult children. I'm the executive director of the Urban Native Youth Association in Vancouver, and I consider myself a community worker, and now I'm an author.
Yeah, and we're calling you today to discuss First Nations 101, which is, first of all, congratulations on becoming a bestseller.
Thank you.
That must be really exciting for you.
Very much so.
Mm-hmm. So the book is now being used in a lot of school curriculums, and it's being used sort of as a primer for issues of First Nations peoples. And what motivated you to write this, and for what reason?
I really believe in community development, and I really believe in trying to educate the public about First Nations issues and to educate ourselves about many issues. I really wanted to give Native youth the best chance possible, to help give them the best chance possible to reach their full potential without having to overcome other people's low expectations and the barriers that are set up for them. And I really think that there's a profound ignorance within this country and across Turtle Island about First Nations history and what we have to offer and what we've contributed to this country. But I also find that people have a real hunger for information, both Native and non-Native people. I really wanted to help them to understand what our shared history in this country is. So we talk about treaties, or we talk about residential schools, or salmon, or lobster, or drinking water. It's not just a First Nations issue. It's a shared issue that affects everybody one way or another. And really for First Nations ourselves to understand some of the where some of our challenges came from, but also the inheritance of the strength and resilience that our ancestors have passed down to us, to have survived this onslaught of externally imposed policies and procedures and actions upon our communities. So I wanted to provide something that was really a 101, like these are the base things that you need to know, but to do it in a really accessible way. So I tried to do, you know, the short pieces of information. Each subject, there's 70-something subjects in the book, so each one's two or three pages long, and then has a list of resources so people can continue to learn after. And really, ultimately, it became a vehicle for awareness about the Native Youth Center Capital Campaign that we're doing in Vancouver.
And we're going to talk about that a little bit later on as well. But for right now, I wanted to go and talk a little bit about, since the show does have a female perspective to it, I wanted to talk a little bit about what it means to be a First Nations woman. And why is it so difficult, first of all, for women who identify as First Nations to express themselves or have their voices heard?
Well, it's really historical reasons that have led to today's reality. So colonization, all of the policies and laws and actions that have led to the marginalization of First Nations women. We were once matrilineal societies or had clan mothers, and really a lot of our roles between the genders were complementary roles versus the religious-based male-dominated societies that have been introduced to our communities. And unfortunately, our men really learned those lessons well. And when you think about the residential school fallout, it added to it. So those unhealthy behaviors that they now have in male-dominated society have really been internalized by a lot of our men, and in some cases our women. When you have 500 years of external assault, it's, you know, led to many forms of internal and lateral violence that have silenced our women. Mostly men are in positions of power, while women do most of the community work. And violence in our community has led to fear. Of course, it's different within each community, how it varies. Excuse me. And I like to say that, I don't like to say, but the way I try to explain it is that silence and shame are literally killing our women. You know, until we confront this history and our current realities, things can't change on any significant level. Women are still forced off the reserve and into the cities, where they're treated as invisible as community members, yet very visible as targets that are exploited and abused and even killed. Mainstream society ignores us or belittles us. First Nations people, especially women, are not valued and are viewed as disposable. And you could see that by all the murdered and missing women and the way that we're overrepresented in being sexually exploited and homeless and many of the other poor social outcomes.
So there's like a long sort of laundry list of things that needs to be tackled here.
For sure.
So I know you briefly covered this, but can you give us, like from your kind of perspective, a history of First Nations women in Canada? I know you talked a little bit about colonialism and the ideas that came with them that affected you. And has there been anything in your own experience that you'd like to share as well?
For sure. Well, I think that First Nations women have been used and abused since first contact by non-First Nations people. With traders and with government and those who were supposed to be our allies and our own men to forge alliances with supposed allies. So it goes right back from the beginning of contact and all of the policies and procedures that have marginalized our people. And then you throw in the residential school experience, which I'll talk about a little bit more later, is that it really has led to some very dysfunctional or unhealthy behaviors that many people are still steeped in, I guess. For myself, you know, my mother, she came out of a very trying, I guess, history. And so she was left with six children as a single mother. She used alcohol to hide her pain, to deal with it. She was, used by men and displaced from her home and culture. She was on welfare. We came down to Vancouver. We lived in the projects. We lived in poverty. And it was really a way for her to escape from the rampant racism that was in Prince Rupert, B.C. at the time. But I can also say that thankfully things have changed, right? So things like this radio show or the anti-violence work that's happening in communities and the Stolen Sisters campaign and vigils and the truth about the residential school is really helping to end the silence that's keeping our women at in harm's way, I guess I would say.
We do talk a lot about how community is really, really crucial to this fight for women's rights, for all women's rights. And I just wanted to reiterate this point again. You did mention that there are a lot of First Nations Aboriginal women that go missing or they're murdered and nobody really seems to care about it. And there is kind of a streak of violence. And I know we've talked about on our show before, for example, drug use or going through the so-called criminal justice system here and they're being disproportionately affected or misrepresented. There's a statistic from StatsCan that says almost 13% of all Aboriginal women age 15 and older have stated that they have been violently victimized. And I feel like this victimization is kind of systematic. So what do you think are the causes for this kind of violence and this kind of disproportionate effect? And why is it so difficult to combat it or to altogether eliminate it?
Well, I would say primarily it's the ongoing colonization within this country. When you have a government and governments that are keep telling us what our rights are or what they aren't, and they make it sound like they're giving us handouts and they're propping up these people who are male or maybe sometimes female who are more focused on the economy than actually rebuilding our communities and help us recover, that is really, really detrimental to our community from like having any significant true change. Again, women's roles have been severely diminished and whitewashed from history. And when nobody's acknowledging that women are actually doing things and a lot of men and some women aren't helping to rebuild communities or raise healthy and hopeful children, it really is really, it's almost impossible to recover at any kind of meaningful level. When you have seven or eight generations of people who have gone through the residential school system and learned all kinds of negative behaviors from the abuses that they suffered, and then you couple that with all of the good things about our culture that was taken away from us, the healing ceremonies, the the rites of passage and women's moontime ceremonies and women's roles and elders' roles and two-spirit people's roles, and, you know, children are no longer viewed as sacred. So a lot of these things are still being felt today. and it keeps the problem hidden. You know, that silence and shame is people are afraid to air our dirty laundry, and they want to perpetuate this romanticization about what Native people are, and when it's, you know, not true in many cases. Of course, it varies from community to community. Some people are, some communities are actually doing better than others, but for the most part, it's still pretty tough out there for all Native people, and especially women and our children.
In your book, you also have a chapter about feminism. What does it mean to be a First Nations woman and a feminist? And is this different than other forms of feminism, or is it kind of in the same vein?
I think it's different. I think there's some Native women who outright say that they're feminists, but I think it's different than what mainstream feminism does. There's very, very, for sure, there's lots of feminist actions that are happening. But I think for a lot of First Nations women, we don't call ourselves feminists, although we are doing feminist actions. We're more as humanists. So for the largest part, mainstream feminism is focused on economic and social equality between men and women. But for us, First Nations women, we're more focused on building community and helping women and men recover from all of those external abuses and to reclaim our traditional teachings, which will ultimately lead to everyone being treated more respectfully and equally. And, you know, returning to our complementary roles as males and females, not in competition with each other.
That's a good distinction to make, actually, the calling yourselves humanists. I like that, too.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, in a lot of ways in mainstream feminism, Native women have, you know, tried to use that as a vehicle to help us. And many times we've been shut down and, you know, led to believe that we're going to be supported. But really, it's under their terms and conditions and, you know, fit into our model rather than making sure that they try to support First Nations women in the way that they want to do feminist work.
Mm-hmm. I'm actually going to ask this question now. It was a little bit lower in the list, but I think this is a good segue. But is it appropriate for members of the community, including feminists, to take on the struggles or the issues of First Nations women? And what would your ideal situation for activism or community awareness look like?
I think that it's appropriate, but they should not try to speak for us or to dismiss our voices while privileging their own analysis and their own needs. Building alliances is really, really important, especially when working with First Nations women. It's an empowering and reciprocal relationship, and it's really one that, unfortunately, like we talked about, Native women's voices have been silenced in this country and even in our communities in some senses. So in some ways, it's good for it to have non-First Nations allies, especially white ones, because that's who people listen to, right? They have much more privileged voice than we do in mainstream society. So ones that are respectful and they're actually trying to support what First Nations women want rather than fulfill their own needs, I think it's completely appropriate.
And I also wanted to bring up this kind of mainstream representation of Native peoples and life on reserves. And oftentimes it comes off as very barren and very desolate and kind of almost, I think it's been described in some outlets as almost a third world kind of situation. Is this an accurate depiction, or how does this affect women and families, or is there something that we're not seeing here?
Well, I think in some cases it's that story is told in a way that blames First Nations people. You know, it's our choice to create this ghettoization, when in reality it's because the government's not living up to the treaties and our inherent rights as First People of this land to be providing resources for really all of the millions and millions of acres of land and lots of other stuff that have happened in this country, which really was a down payment that our ancestors ensured would be available for us today. Because, you know, as our elders say, we should be thinking about the seven generations to come, and that's what our ancestors did. But we're trying to live up to our end of the bargain, but the Canadian government and the honor of the crown, or the dishonor of the crown, is not been living up to what they should be doing. Excuse me. And again, that colonial legacy has led to many of our homes on reserves been unsafe for women and children. Not all, but many. It varies from community to community, depending on how intact their culture is, you know, which would either strengthen or weaken women's roles. If they have self-government, if women are in roles of influence and authority, you know, that sort of stuff. Many women are forced to flee violence to cities where they continue to struggle and are, you know, their voices even silenced even more, and they become invisible in the city other than to be exploited. Our women are more likely to focus on community development and family issues, but men are still in positions of authority and power. And I purposely don't use the term leadership because I think in many cases they're not showing true leadership. They're not ensuring that everybody in our community is doing well. They're not trying to rebuild our traditional forms of governance. So it's, you know, it's difficult. But I also think that much like the downtown east side, there may be visible signs that things aren't going well. But in many of our communities, there's some families, some individuals, some traditional people who are trying their hardest to make sure that our communities recover our traditional ways and become our former proud and healthy selves. So even though visibly it may look like it's dark and barren, there are some very bright lights within our communities that are trying to rebuild our community. So it's, you know, I could see both sides of it for sure.
So for people, for example, people in radio or television, people who make media, or even just people who are exposed to First Nations, what can they do or what can be done in general to kind of dispel these negative images and replace them with more positive ones?
Well, I think people really need to educate themselves. When you listen to stories in the media or you listen to government talk about First Nations people, you have to ask what's the story that's not being told. First Nations people have been really good about using social media to get the truth out about stories. And you've seen this happen with Attawapiskat. When the government was making it sound like, you know, there's $90 million that went into that community or whatever the number was, First Nations people were making sure that they had the truth online, right? So if you Google anything, you'll be able to find out the information, whether it's misinformation or the truth. But First Nations people are really trying to ensure that there is access to that information. And, of course, First Nations 101, I think, is a good starting point so that First Nations people can understand our history in this country. The residential school experience has such a profound effect on our communities. But most of us don't truly understand what its impacts are on us as individuals and families and communities. So I try to shed light on it in my book. There's been a huge reconnection to culture and traditional teachings in the past 20 years or so, and people are relying on that to recover and rebuild our, you know, ourselves as individuals and our families and our communities. You can provide housing and funding and other things, but community and its people will not truly change for the better until we as individuals do, and we stand up and end the silence and the shame and try to bring about the truth, both within our communities and outside of our communities.
And just going on that tangent there with First Nations 101, you're actually coming to Toronto and doing an event here at the Toronto Women's Bookstore. And this is going to be on Saturday, September the 22nd. And you'll also be at the Word on the Street Festival on Sunday, September 23rd from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. So can you tell us a little bit more about coming here and what you hope to accomplish?
For sure. Well, First Nations 101 is in bookstores across the country and up into the territories. But even though it's a bestseller, 95% of the book sales are in BC. So I'm trying to do, you know, travel to different parts of the country so that people become more aware of First Nations 101 and how it can help them in the community work that they're doing. So I'm really excited on Saturday, September 22nd. I'll be there with Lee Miracle, you know, who's one of our most preeminent authors. She has like 15 books out, and she's a community activist, and she's one of the most well-respected elders in our community, and I have such respect for her. And, you know, when I look back on when I, you know, what made me think that I could write a book, I remember being around when she was releasing one of her books and just being shocked that there was a Native woman who wrote a book. So I think that was the first seed that took hold in my head to be able to think that I could do this. So I think it's just, it's inspirational. And the Word on the Street, of course, is a big event, and it's down, sorry, I don't have the address, but it's down near the Royal Ontario Museum in the park there. It's about 6 square blocks, and there's hundreds of people there, and I'll be at booth 219. If people want to come down and visit or buy a book or get an autograph, that would be fantastic.
Okay. Well, I'll have that information as well. I can find that. So you're also donating $1 from the sale of each of your books to the Native Youth Center Capital Campaign in Vancouver. So can you tell us a little bit about the campaign and where people can find more information?
For sure. I tried to keep the book as cheap as possible. It's a 288-page book, but I only sell it for $20 because I don't want people to walk away and not buy the book because it's $25. I don't need to make a lot of money on this. So in the little bit of money that I'll be making, I really am so dedicated to trying to build this Native Youth Center in Vancouver. We currently have the land. We have government who's supporting. We really need the federal government to come on board for sure. But if anybody wants to find out more, they could look at www.nativeyouthcenter.ca or www.unya.bc.ca. We're trying to build a youth center here that brings together our 20 programs into one space and to just make it a much more dynamic space and bigger and really to give Native youth what they deserve. Right, so that they can have access to positive activities, to their culture, to elders, and have a... Vancouver is becoming really, really gentrified, so we want to make sure that we have a solid place in this community so that Native youth always have a somewhere to come.
And for that, on the topic of the book as well, how many have you sold already?
Well, as of this morning, 5,200 and something. So, and that's, I just released it last June to celebrate National Aboriginal History Month.
And what kind of people are buying these books?
It's a really, really diverse crowd. At the launch, there was about 250 people that were there, and I probably only knew about one-third of them. And people who came up to buy the book and get it signed were like religious-based organizations who were trying to do reconciliation work, people from universities, people from government agencies, treaty agencies, community organizations are using it for their board of directors or new staff training. Government's using it for some of their training. Some universities are starting, I think there's about 10 universities. It's on my website, FirstNations101.com, if people want to see how to order it or where it's been used. Excuse me. So it's really, it's so diverse. A lot of tourists are buying it. A lot of young Native people are buying it, and really, when they come up to me and tell me that it's meaningful in their lives, that makes it totally worth it.
Congratulations. That sounds like a huge feat, especially to come from so many diverse populations.
Yeah, fantastic. And thank you for helping to promote it.
It's so important. It's my pleasure. And just before we kind of wrap this up, is for people who are interested or want to know more, is there any way they can contact you or ways they can order the book or anything else that you'd like to add?
Yeah, they can find out more about the book by checking out the Facebook page and liking it. It's Facebook/FirstNations101. Or they could look on our website, FirstNations101.com, and the email is info@FirstNations101.com.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time out to speak with us today. And,
okay.
Is there anything else you'd like to finish up with?
No, just thank you very much, and keep up the good work that you're doing, especially about talking about violence in our community, mm-hmm. because we really need to do that to be able to change things. So thank you for doing that work.
And likewise to you as well. Congratulations with all your success. And I wish you all the best in the future as well.
Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.